Without further ado, I'm going to introduce our first speaker tonight, Derek Jewell. Derek is well known to almost everyone in this room, I'm sure. Trained at the University of Oxford, specialized in GI under the famous Sidney Truelove at Oxford, and then went on to Stanford, which I didn't know about him until I was reading this, and then the Royal Free Hospital in London, and after Dr. Truelove's retirement, returned to Oxford. He's currently an emeritus professor of gastroenterology at the University of Oxford and has served as the president of the British Society of Gastro, a member of the research committee of the Royal College of Physicians, and he received the mentorship award from the AGA in 2007. Dr. Jewell also was a friend of Dr. Kirzner's, and a number of DDWs ago when it was in Chicago went to visit him at his apartment, and I know that Dr. Kirzner valued that tremendously. So please join me in welcoming Professor Derek Jewell to the podium.
Good. Thank you very much, indeed. And it's a very great honor to have been asked to take part in this symposium. I'm very grateful to David for the invitation. I've known Joe for very many years, and as you just heard, it was just 3 years ago, I spent a delightful hour with him in his apartment when he was sat in front of his computer. His failing eyesight meant that he had to look at it through a big magnifying glass, but he was still reviewing and learning. It was very impressive. Now, I've got to reflect on the IBD as it's developed over the years, with a special emphasis on management. Well, you all know how to manage the disease, so I was wondering about what I could tell you. So this is a slight ramble. It'll be a bit of a history lesson, and hopefully a few anecdotes that you may not be aware of. Now, there was an amazing meeting in Bologna in 1988. That was celebrating 900 years of the medical school in Bologna. But there were two almost 90-year-olds sat there in the front row, as you can see with Joe there with Sidney Truelove. And it was a great privilege because I had to take them for lunch, and we had to walk quite a long way for lunch. And neither of them were particularly agile at that stage. And I had one on each arm. And I know photographs were taken, and I have sent many emails to people who were at the meeting. And you see David Sacker and Herbert Locks just sat there a bit further back. But I can't find the photograph, so you had to make do with this one. The milestones, I think, for UC are just interesting just to go through, because it was 1859, as I will show you, that UC was first recognized as a disease distinct from bacterial dysentery. In the 1920s, it was well characterized clinically. In the 1930s, bacteria were thought to be the major etiological factor, and sulfonamides were given, and we'll come back to that. 40s and 50s, we go into the first effective therapy for the disease, sulfasalazine and corticosteroids, followed by the thiopurines. The surgeons were not far behind, and the introduction of the pouch in the 1970s has transformed surgery for ulcerative colitis. The 1980s saw refinement in managing severe attacks, and then of course we go into the era of biologics and small molecules, which I will leave Steph to talk to. For Crohn's disease, I think the big milestone was obviously 1932, with the description of the disease, and I'm not implying any thoughts about Scotland becoming an independent country, because of course it was a Scotsman, DL, in about 1913, that recognized that all ileal strictures were not tuberculosis. But he really didn't carry that on forward, and so that's why I put 1932 as a major landmark. The surgeons were soon learned that you couldn't chop the disease out, and by the 1970s, the concept of minimal surgery, managing strictures with strictureplasties, limited resections, really began to change the whole surgical nature of managing the disease. Therapy was difficult because Crohn's disease was such a difficult disease to manage that people didn't know how to create what we now would call endpoints for clinical trials. So treatment was just as if the patients had ulcerative colitis. So it was sulfasalazine, it was steroids, and subsequently azathioprine and the thiopurines. And the real milestone, I think, was in 1976 when the CDAI was published in Gastroenterology, because that meant that you could actually measure something about the disease objectively. And then we go into the period of evidence-based trials, which you all know about. So let's go back to the beginning. 19th century London was a cesspit of bloody diarrhea. And Samuel Wilkes, a physician at Guy's Hospital, recognized that there was a much more chronic disorder, which was not bacterial dysentery. He published a case on the morbid appearances of the colon of the unfortunate Miss Banks. And Miss Banks had a very nasty colitis, and it was widely thought that her general practitioner had been poisoning her with mercury. He was arrested, charged, and brought up in court, in the Royal Courts of Justice, was actually let off, but two or three years later, he was again arrested for giving people mercury poisoning, and he was actually hanged in the end. That's by the way. By the early 20th century, the London physicians had managed to gather about 300 cases of ulcerative colitis, this new disease. And there was a very heated debate published in the Proceedings of the Royal Society of Medicine. And the debate was whether it was bacterial, which most people thought. But tinned foods were coming in and preservatives were being added to foods. And so there was a strong lobby for that being the cause of this disease. And of course, there was a psychosomatic lobby as well. And you could wonder whether we have actually made any progress since 1909. But now, this is Sir Arthur Hurst. He was a physician at Guy's Hospital. He founded the British Society of Gastroenterology. But he was really responsible for the first clinical description of ulcerative colitis. And he described it as a gradual onset. He recognized that limited distal disease could present with constipation. He'd spent many years in Egypt. He knew about bacillary dysentery and amoebic dysentery, and he knew that ulcerative colitis was quite different from amoebiasis, but was very similar endoscopically to bacillary dysentery. Of course, he had no treatment, and treatment was these things here. He liked his colonic irrigation with a silver salt until the authorities decided that was dangerous, so he changed to tannic acid, which patients didn't like because it was painful. You see soured milk on the list there, a probiotic, maybe, an anti-dysenteric serum. Now, editors of scientific journals were not very vigorous in the 1920s, and so the report of this experiment is not actually very well documented. But he took anti-serum from patients recovering from dysentery, and he infused that into his colitic potions in increasing volumes on consecutive days. He soon learnt that anaphylaxis could be a problem, so there was adrenaline handy. But he using this technique, he really had some dramatic effects, which he published in 1935. And interestingly, from today's perspective, that he found that if he went on treating these patients until the sigmoidoscopic appearances went back to normal, then they did not relapse nearly as quickly as if they had residual endoscopic inflammation. Now, Hirst and Dr. Krohn were in quite frequent correspondence with one another. There's a little letter, really, by Krohn and Dr. Rosenach, and I don't know who he was, who'd also tried anti-dysenteric serum, said it was wonderful. There is Dr. Krohn, and you all know him, of him. Now, the two effective treatments, sulfonamides and corticosteroids, and I thought I'd say a little bit about the sulfonamides. They were discovered in Germany in 1932 by Domag, and it was rapidly shown to be effective against a number of bacterial infections, but particularly Diplostreptococcus. It's an interesting bit of history that Domag was awarded the Nobel Prize for discovering the sulfonamides, but Hitler refused to allow him to accept it. It was trialed in rheumatoid arthritis with very little benefit. But the Diplostreptococcus story got over to Dr. Bargan, the Mayo Clinic, who tried it and it didn't really work very well. In the meantime, the professor of microbiology here, Gail Dack, together with Drs. Palmer and Kersner, had been describing Bacterium necrophorum in the stool of colitic patients. And so they did some trials of both sulfaguanidine and sulfanilamide. Now, it didn't have very much effect, but what was so beautiful about those trials, when you go back and look at the papers, was that the clinical progress was followed by assays of the sulfonamide, both in serum and in feces, and by microbiological culture. So it was a really beautifully designed clinical studies with a scientific rigor behind them. So the story of the sulfonamides then comes to Nanna Svartz, who was a rheumatologist in Sweden. She knew about aspirin, of course, that had been known as an anti-inflammatory for rheumatoid arthritis for many years. But she had the idea that if you link the sulfonamide to aspirin, then and gave that to patients with rheumatoid arthritis, then the whole thing would get better because she thought rheumatoid was an infective disorder. So finally, the pharmacists in Pharmacia created sulfasalazine. And the other person here is my mentor, Sidney Truelove, and we'll come back to his contribution in a second. I should have said that Nanna Svartz published a paper in about 1947 on the treating about 160 patients with rheumatoid arthritis with this new drug, sulfasalazine. Nobody's joints got better, but there were some patients in that study who also had ulcerative colitis, and she noted that the colitis got better. And we had lots of uncontrolled studies of sulfasalazine, but then we had some placebo-controlled trials in active colitis from the Central Middlesex, Hugh Barron, George Moshevitz, Avery Jones, and a group in Cambridge. The maintenance effects of sulfasalazine, again, beautifully shown in a controlled trial, again from the Central Middlesex Hospital, George Moshevitz and John Leonard Jones, and Avery Jones. And then 1973 comes along, and Sidney Chulove shows that that maintenance effect is preserved over time. He then did a maintenance study of 1 gram, 2 grams, and 4 grams, and showed that for sulfasalazine, 2 grams was the optimal dose. Now, here's Sidney in his office, and he was a great thinker. And he was thinking, and I sat in a chair on the other side of the desk behind the door, debating about whether it was sulfasalazine, the 5-aminosalicylic acid, or the sulfapyridine that was the active ingredient. And you see all those red box files on the top of the shelf. That contains all the patient data, the 624 patients that form the basis of those papers on the course and prognosis of ulcerative colitis. So Sidney came up with this idea of testing these three compounds in enema form. And he had a young Bangladeshi research fellow just arrived, that's Azad Khan on the right. On the left, with the moustaches, a very young Massimo Campieri. And in the middle is Bupiyanand, who is now in Bailor as a hepatologist. But Azad Khan was put to work to do this enema study. And you will all know this, the results of this study. And it clearly showed that it was the 5-ASA that was producing just as good results as the sulfasalazine enema, but there was very little effect with sulfapyridine. So that, I have a pointer here. Yes, I do, sorry. So there's sulfasalazine splitting into sulfapyridine and mesalazine, as we now call it. And there was a great flurry in the pharmaceutical industry, as you all know, with different mesalazine formulations and pro-molecules like balsalazide and olsalazine. But I'm not going to dwell on that because you all know about it. Let's just step back and go to corticosteroids, first introduced in 1946, in medicine, again, predominantly for rheumatological conditions. But it was again the Oxford study by Sidney Chulove of intravenous cortisone for severe colitis in 1954 that I think was a real landmark, a very nicely performed study. It meant that people with severe colitis had a dramatic reduction in their time in hospital. And as you can see, there was a dramatic fall in mortality. The 60s were shown to be many trials showing oral prednisolone over placebo and the development of topical therapy. And I remember asking Sidney how he got the idea of topical therapy. And it was because the dermatologists were using steroids for the skin. And he thought, well, if you can have topical therapy on the skin, why can't you have topical therapy on the rectal mucosa? And that's how the whole thing started. And then, of course, with the 1980s, we get steroids with high first-pass metabolism, again, reducing side effects very considerably. So prior to 1950, there was no effective treatment. I had one patient I looked after in the early 80s who'd been treated by Arthur Hirst. He developed ulcerative colitis at the age of 15, and he sat in a Guy's Hospital bed for 18 months, having nothing but soured milk and various diets and so on. So it's easy, I think, to forget when we see the difficult patients in our tertiary referral clinics how much progress we've made in the 50 years from 1950 up to about 2000, when the biologics became so much more prevalent. Mesalazine had far fewer effects of sulfasalazine. We could use it in higher doses, and that's been highly effective in ulcerative colitis and has reduced corticosteroid usage. Thiopurines, again, reduce steroid usage. And one of the first trials of azathioprine in Crohn's disease was done right here with Dr. Kirzner and Dr. Rosenberg. And mortality has improved, and improved surgical techniques, minimally invasive surgery has actually been a great boon for many of our patients. You've heard about the NFIC, the CCFA, its origins, and Joe's participation in that. And the advent of these patient organizations around the world in most countries now has meant our patients are well informed. The Danish studies and other studies on this side of the Atlantic have shown that for the majority of our patients, they're well for most of the time. And life expectancy is now normal for UC and fairly near normal for Crohn's disease. The problem is the refractory disease in about 15% of our patients, which causes all the problem, and Steph will tell you how to manage that. Just finally, I would like to say I've been personally very grateful to Joe Kirzner for two things. One, for some animal models of colitis that he developed, and secondly, for recognizing that the disease could affect many members in a single family. He published a paper with Dr. Goldgraber about colitis in animals based on something called the Arthus reaction and the Auer reaction. The Auer model of inflammation postulated that circulate immune complexes would deposit in sites of previous inflammation. And Drs. Goldgraber and Kirzner developed a colitis in rabbits that had been immunized with egg albumin. We changed the model a little bit, and we took unimmunized rabbits, and we gave them a little bit of 1 mL of a formalin enema, which just produces a bit of hyperemia in the rectum. And then about 2 hours later, we gave them an intravenous injection of immune complexes. And that was human serum albumin added to a rabbit anti-serum of human albumin. I won't go into the details, but we developed, these rabbits developed a very acute colitis over the next 2 weeks. And we published that with Humphrey Hodgson. I thought, we've always had this notion that patients with colitis can be very well, and then they suddenly get an intercurrent infection, sore throat or a cold, and they relapse. And I thought, well, maybe, these rabbits, if they were pre-immunized to bacterial antigen, and then we gave them immune complexes, maybe they would go on and develop a chronic colitis. So the next experiment was tested that, and sure enough, even 12 months after the initial experiment, they showed epithelial flattening, atrophy of the glands, and evidence of some chronic inflammation. We perhaps ought to go back and revisit that model because we didn't take it any further and nobody else has. That idea for the animal model came directly from studies done here. And then, of course, in the late 1970s, he described in IBD in multiply affected families. And when Gunnar Jennerott, Kurt Tisk, showed the, did the twin study in Sweden, it really kicked off the genetic studies that we're now so familiar with. I remember sitting in David Wetherill's office about 1990 and said, look, how do we study the genetics of IBD when we don't know what we're looking for? And he said, I don't know. And it was just shortly after that conversation that the microsatellite markers were described by Mark Lathrop and others. And that, of course, gave us the idea of looking at families with siblings, two or more siblings affected with the disease, and looking at linkage by descent using these microsatellite markers. But it started here, and one is very grateful for that. Now, we've talked about Joe Kersner. David mentioned him as a clinician, but he was a great inspirer, a great teacher, and the center of excellence that he developed here and the way it's prospered and going on to prosper is a true testament to his lifetime's work. And so with that, I would like to finish, but just to congratulate David on, just in the last 24 hours, I think, hearing that he's been actually made chief of gastroenterology here. So the excellence will continue. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. That was terrific.
You know, we're happy to entertain some questions or people who have other reflections for a minute or two before we go on. I don't want this to feel so stiff and formal. If you have other thoughts that you guys would like to share, or we can do that at the end after Steph's talk.
Sure. I have known Dr. Kersner since 1978, and I think I told you, you'd go to his clinic on Saturday morning, he had his IBD clinic, everybody would fly in, and he'd introduce the medical school, here's my colleague, Dr. So-and-so, and I felt very embarrassed that these people had flown in from all over the world and would see me first, but he was a great teacher. And a great mentor is very, very important to me in my career. And it was the reason I went into gastroenterology. Not only did he work at Cloudy Bowel Disease, of course, you may not know, he had some expertise in irritable bowel syndrome. And he had his little bottles of deodorized tincture of opium and belladonna drops. And I said, you can just get some Donatal, you know. And, no. But it's a show, you know. You shouldn't put it in the drops. And, he was very beloved. And one other little anecdote, he took care of people from all over the world, and he was very well known. So one day, he had taken care of a world team in the Middle East, and a big rug appeared in Chicago. And it was just addressed to JBK, University of Chicago.
When I was a fellow, I took care of one of the generals from Morocco with him. And after the general went home, and there's a whole story behind that, but when the general went home, a rug appeared in my apartment lobby. And one day I got home, and it was from the ambassador. And it was this bright pink Moroccan rug. And so at the time, we had one child, the other one hadn't arrived yet, and my wife said, well, you know, if we have a girl, maybe we'll use this, but even if we have a girl, I don't think we're going to use this. It was this ugly, ugly rug. So anyway, we stored at my parents in their basement, and relatively recently, a few years ago, when we purchased the house we're living in now, my mom says, all right, now it's time for you to clean out our basement. Come get that ugly rug. So we came and got the rug, and we donated it to a place that does it. It was in pristine shape because we never used it. And then Dr. Kersner, when he was towards the end of his life, said to my wife, who was working as his assistant, I really wanted to get you and David a housewarming gift. You've both been so nice to me, and I have something for you. And behind his couch in his living room, rolled up, was an exact replica of that same rug, which he got also from the general and the ambassador. And she's like, oh my God. Only he had used it. So this one wasn't even as nice. Yeah. How many people here had gotten notes from Dr. Kirzner over the years? Yeah, I mean, that was what he was known for. Any other comments, Ira?
I think one of the amazing things, I didn't know that he started his career interested in infectious disease, but when you think about it, I mean, for all of us who knew us, he was practicing medicine before penicillin. I mean, that is even more interesting when I now learn that he started his career with interest in infectious disease. Nowadays, you know, penicillin is so far in the distance, but imagine practicing medicine before antibiotics.